good evening or good afternoon. We should say it's summertime after all, and the sun is shining. Welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we tell you each week, this conversation can include you if you'd like to join us. Our phone number is 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, use that one. And from the neighbor islands, it's 877-941-3689. Now, we hear it in Donald Trump's presidential campaign with promises to make America great again by bringing back jobs and saying no to trade deals. It's in the Brexit vote and in subsequent calls by other countries in the UK and the EU to do likewise and chart their own futures. The move toward nationalism and away from globalization continues to escalate. Is what we're witnessing the end of the globalized world as we know it? This afternoon on Town Square, we pick up the discussion begun on The Conversation with International Relations Professor Jairus Grove, the director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies, and we're joined by University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization Research Fellow and Professor of Economics Sumner LaCroix, and you about the world that's changing all around us. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Thanks.
Good to talk to you. Now, although there's been a lot of talk about the end of globalization that has flowed from the Brexit vote and even earlier this year, I can remember having this conversation at least 10 years ago. This is nothing that's been exceedingly new, but it has changed in the last year incredibly. I'm curious about the view that you each see in terms of how globalization is moving toward a very different place than we talked about 10 years ago. And Sumner, go ahead and start since you're our newbie on the panel.
You know, globalization has always led to tensions. If we just focus on one aspect of globalization, trade between countries, we've seen a tremendous reduction in trade barriers over the last 50 years, partly because of the World Trade Organization process that's reduced tariffs, reduced quotas. We've seen all sorts of regional agreements, such as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and we've seen bilateral agreements between countries. These have all lowered trade barriers, and yet there's a paradox of trade. The paradox of trade generally is that a country gains, and yet there are winners and losers inside the country. One of the things that we're starting to realize now via very detailed economic studies of the losers is that the losses are highly concentrated. That there are certain cities that bear very intense losses and certain industries that bear very intense losses. One good example in the United States is Providence, Rhode Island, that's really been devastated by the loss of manufacturing industries there. There's numerous other cities that just the rise of China, China's integration into the world trading system has led to a loss of jobs in the United States. And yet, when you look at these agreements, in general, they tend to lead to an increase in jobs and an increase in income in the United States.
Yeah, I think it's a question about the distribution of that income. So I think it's not necessarily that material changes are happening in globalization, but that the kind of aspirational or ideological piece of globalization hasn't been able to fulfill a lot of the promises that people thought would happen. So the new economies that were supposed to come and replace those labor jobs have been slow to develop. And at the same time, and we talked about this a little bit last week, you know, it happened at a particular time where austerity really gained a lot of political traction, both in the United States and in Europe. So at the same time as you're having pretty massive economic dislocation, the kinds of safety nets that we provided by the state just weren't there. So we have a reduction in everything from food stamps to retraining, right? We have, of all things, reductions in Pell grants for people to go back to school. And so, you know, everyone knew there would be dislocations in globalization, but I don't think anyone suspected that states would, in some sense, sabotage that transformation or that transition.
Were either one of you surprised by the Brexit vote?
I was surprised that they won. I thought it would be close, but I thought it would be a close remain. And so a pretty definitive leave was surprising.
I'm very surprised that the leave campaign won. In many ways, because I think that the rational thing for the British voters to do would have been to stay in the European Union. There's all sorts of benefits that Britain gets out of staying in the European Union. But I think that immigration was the big issue. And it's not just immigration. It's also the connection between immigration and terrorism. Regardless of what the actual connections are, I think there was a rising fear among people in Britain that the increase in immigration was leading to an increase in the possibility for terrorism. They looked at the EU management of borders, and they didn't really like what they saw. They see all the refugees coming in from North Africa and from the and from the chaos in the Middle East. And they basically said, we're not sure we want the EU managing our borders, even though the EU wasn't managing the borders. I think there was this perception that by being part of the EU that they're going to get increased immigration, and that immigration was just out of control in Britain. The percentage of foreign workers over the last two decades has risen from about 5% of the labor force to about 10% of the labor force. And much of the increase was concentrated at the lower end of the skill spectrum. A lot of medium skilled construction workers, for example. Although there's also some high end people who came into work in the city in London in the financial sector. So I think if we didn't have immigration, if all we were left with were the standard globalization concerns with the EU and with the world economy of foreign direct investment and trade and the increasing technological integration, I don't think that we would have had a leave vote. I think it was immigration that really drove that leave vote.
Immigration, and also the fact that last year we saw, and into this year we saw, so much of a crisis being driven by where Syrian refugees were and were not going to be taken?
Yeah, but I think it's also a timing issue. You know, I think if the economy was in the upswing, if the EU integration had happened more quickly and hadn't just happened on the heels of Grexit in Greece and possibly even withdrawal in Spain, and there hadn't been this sort of level of real disdain for the ability of the state to reintegrate a lot of people who were never going to get jobs again, then I'm not sure that immigration would have had the same kind of effect. You know, it's easy to say that immigration is the cause of something, but in almost all cases, immigration is the thing that politicians mobilize against to scapegoat what is already a huge level of dissatisfaction. I mean, if you look at where the majority of people are being resettled as refugees, which are places like London, they're in metropoles or in places even in Ireland, those aren't the leave votes, right? The leave votes are happening in relatively low populated northern regions of England that used to be primarily manufacturing regions. They're the Detroit and Baltimore of the United Kingdom. And so, you know, I mean, again, there's certainly a connection, but I think we can't overplay that connection given the direct sort of material impact of it isn't clear.
You know, I think the other thing that we kind of forget here in the United States is we look at our own economy, and what we see is a slow but steady recovery since 2009. We sometimes forget about the steady. We really have had a very consistent recovery, but it hasn't been fast. We haven't had a rapid recovery. And so the pain has been extended for a lot of people here in the U.S. But if you look at Britain has had a much slower recovery. They've really struggled. Regardless of what one thinks about the government's policies, they had also a big banking meltdown. A lot of the banks there went under. They had to be bailed out by the government. And that economy has struggled more than the U.S. economy to recover. And so I think the economic mood in Britain, I was a professor at the London School of Economics. I was a visiting scholar at the London School of Economics in 2013. And you could just comparing the moods of the countries then, you could see that people were upset that Britain had not recovered as fast as the U.S. And even today, we're clearly outpacing Britain. And so that lack of robust economic growth was, I think, clearly a factor in the vote.
If you're just joining us today on Town Square, we're taking a look at what's happening in the world as we see globalization. Well, a lot of countries moving away from support of a globalized world and toward more nationalistic sentiments within the EU, certainly within countries within the EU and within the UK. And what does that mean for the US? And later we'll talk about what that might mean for Hawaii, too. We want to hear what you have to say. If you're paying attention to this, does this have relevance in your life as you look out into the world? Or is it something that's making you feel even more insulated? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you call us from the neighbor islands, use the 877 number. If you're listening to the live stream someplace else, call us on that 877-941-3689 number. We're going to go to Matthew calling us from Kaimuki. Aloha, Matthew, and welcome to Town Square. Matthew, are you there? Matthew? Okay. I don't hear him on the line. Okay, we'll try one more time. Matthew, are you there? Nope, not hearing him. All right, Matthew, you'll have to call us back. 941-3689, since you're in Kaimuki, that's the number to use. 941-3689, or from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Do you think that when all the discussion about Brexit was happening, that anyone really had the full idea of what that might mean for just the UK. I mean, we already saw the referendum in Scotland not that long ago. Certainly Ireland has a lot to lose too. But the idea of not having a UK seems to be a place that really wasn't discussed in fullness until well after the vote, with people even saying, well, I really didn't think that Leave was going to, you know, was going to win, but I wanted to make a statement. And gee, could we have a do-over?
I think people wanted to make a statement. I think the people who voted to leave just wanted to make a statement that they were dissatisfied with the state of the EU. Certainly in Britain too, it's easy to see some dissatisfaction with the EU project's stated goal of bringing countries ever closer together. You know, forming a federal government in Europe that became a bigger and bigger part of the governance structure in Europe. I think there was a point where people were like, okay, the EU project is big enough. We're not sure we want to be part of an ever closer Europe. We want to retain some national sovereignty rights. But again, I want to emphasize what I said before, which is I think immigration really drove a lot of this and fears of possible terrorism related to immigration.
Yeah, I mean, as a political scientist, one of the other things that it raises is how bad we are at measuring how people are feeling in any given moment. So I think one of the things about Brexit that's really shocking is how bad the polling data was. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's so much concern in the United States, is that what we're really finding is that there's this kind of technological transformation and also kind of fracturing of publics, where either our selection methods aren't very good, or we're not actually reaching people because we're still using things like telephones rather than getting to enough cell phones, or figuring out some way to really do good polling over things like texting or over the internet. But there seems to be something even out of touch with the ability for there to be this kind of feedback between the public and government. So if we're as wrong as we were about the Leave vote, right, what does that mean about all the other kind of polling data that supposedly politicians are basing their kind of representational practices after? We don't know. But it certainly says we should take a much greater look at the level of discontent and where that discontent is.
Let's talk a little bit about that discontent, because it happens in little pockets in certainly, as we saw with Brexit, that were somewhat unexpected. I mean, not all of them were, clearly, but looking at the fact that the U.S. has lost so much manufacturing, we've watched so many jobs go overseas, and the jobs that were retained here weren't jobs that would be, Apple has most of its employees elsewhere, maybe 1,000 or so in the United States, and they're not doing manufacturing. How do we get around some of that when we hear this little chestnut about bringing jobs back or bringing back manufacturing, of certainly nothing like what we saw in the 50s or 60s? You know, when you hear these little chestnuts coming out in a political campaign, it seems to be rather disingenuous in some ways to be talking about it in those ways without saying that, here's a plan for it.
Well, if you ask why is it that the United States has much less manufacturing employment than it had 75 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago, or even 10 years ago. The answer is relatively straightforward. It's increased productivity of U.S. workers. There's only so much stuff that we tend to want around. We get better and better and better at producing manufactured goods. Now, on the manufacturing side, productivity just stays so strong. Year in and year out, we get great gains in productivity in manufacturing. That means each worker ends up producing a lot more. To produce the same amount, you don't need as many workers. And so manufacturing jobs shrink, even though the output of the manufacturing sector doesn't really change all that much. Okay, then add in two big events happening that are really events that are just massive events for the last for the last 25 years, and that's the addition of China and India to the world trading system. And yes, I think that has led some of the recent studies by David Outor, an outstanding professor who studies trade and labor markets at MIT. His studies, really show the loss of jobs, particularly during the decade of the 2000s to China when China joined the WTO. There was a loss of jobs over that period, but most of the jobs that have been lost in the United States have been due to increased productivity. So it's not exactly like they've gone overseas. Okay, there's been a few jobs that have gone overseas, but we're not going to get those jobs back. And we're talking about making T-shirts. Those jobs are going to be staying in countries. Those are simple jobs where people who are paid less have. basically can do those jobs much better than people here in the United States. It's really very straightforward. So I find some of the notion that we can bring jobs back. We see this both from Sanders supporters in the U.S. and from Trump supporters. We can bring jobs back. I think this is a bit of a mirage. It's distracting us from much more important issues.
Yeah, I think there's also there's gasoline on that fire too, which is that in addition to the increasing productivity, that increasing productivity is coming from automation. And so we're even seeing the reduction in manufacturing jobs in places like India and China and Vietnam, such that we need to start worrying about what does a Chinese Brexit look like? What does a kind of Indian Brexit look like? What are the kinds of backlashes where developing countries that thought they were going to be able to kind of leapfrog in the way that somewhere like South Korea did through inexpensive manufacturing or cheap labor just won't be able to? And so Jeffrey Sachs has a paper that's been making the rounds recently that it's based on some different models about particularly American automation, but that as much as 30% of the kinds of jobs in the United States will cease to exist. And they're really important kinds of jobs. So, for instance, retail, waiters and waitresses. So the service economy is where most of that economic growth has come back since Obama sort of pushed us after 2008. And those jobs are actually, I think, some of the most vulnerable to things like automation or changes in the way that kind of fee-for-service relationships take place. So it's not just a question of bringing jobs back. There aren't jobs to bring back. And then in addition to that, we're likely to keep steadily losing the kinds of jobs where growth is taking place. So we need questions to be asked about how we distribute wealth, how we support people who will never be employed.
Right. And going back to what does it look like to have an economy of the future that is, in fact, here now? What do we do to be able to make that a meaningful conversation? Because very clearly, if you listen to all of the rhetoric that's happening now in the current presidential campaign, this is not a topic that's coming up. I mean, the word jobs just connotes a certain thing to everyone, but not necessarily some of the realities that either of you is bringing up into the conversation.
For most of us, for most people in the United States and in Hawaii, jobs mean service jobs. It doesn't mean manufacturing jobs. If we're sitting here in Hawaii, there are very few manufacturing jobs left. And so what we're talking about in Hawaii is service jobs. We're talking about teachers, doctors, nurses, people working in the tourism industry, people working in banking and insurance. These are all service jobs. And that's actually where the discussion ought to be, is how do we create better jobs within the service industry? For instance, for Hawaii, the idea of bringing back manufacturing jobs is that's a foolish idea. I mean, it's not going to happen. We're not well set up for it. We're far away from most markets.
But it'll be micro manufacturing, maybe little boutique clothing, but not at the level which we've been talking about for a long time.
That might happen. We might see something like that happen, but that's not going to be a big producer of jobs. I mean, we're going to see our jobs produced via the service industries. And I just can't
imagine replacing nurses, though.
In Japan, I mean, there's the robot. There's robot nurses.
That's true.
That give sponge baths. Patients have found them to be at least as satisfactory as the real thing.
Yeah, and there, I was at the National Institute of Science and Technology flew me over to Japan to talk about the future of aging, and we were there with South Korea and all these other countries that are really having these demographic inverse booms, right? Really old populations and really shrinking populations. And automation seems to be the answer, right? So we're really talking about robots that are caregivers. At the very least, using these kinds of technologies, particularly sort of telemobility technology, so that one doctor can reach out to several people through robotic sort of prosthetics. So it's not that you don't have doctors anymore, but you might only have one doctor for three cities, and he may be or she may be operating various kinds of devices. So Johns Hopkins has a fully automated surgical robot that's actually quite good and has fewer incidences of infection. And so I do think those things are going to be automated, or at the very least, the numbers of human personnel to fulfill those positions will be much, much smaller.
Which all goes back to what is the economy of the future going to look like? We're going to talk about that in a second, but I promised we would get some callers in. And thank you very much for your patience. Going to Amanda calling us from Mililani. Aloha, Amanda. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi.
Hi there. Amanda, are you there?
Am I getting a lot of feedback? Am I off the...
Amanda, you need to turn down your radio.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, if you turn down your radio, we can hear you and you'll hear us much better too. Thanks.
Okay. It's kind of a complex question. I don't really know if it's a question. In terms of just putting together the concepts of supply and demand, sustainability, capitalism and globalization, and and the reality that we have great technology, we have great sort of systems in place. There's potential for globalization in our economies, but not consideration of the values shifts that need to occur in accepting the reality that everyone can't have everything. And I just wonder if any of the folks that you have on right now feel as though we could get to that place.
All right, Amanda, let's see if we talk about that a little bit. I mean, certainly she's alluding to the American dream. You know, everybody's going to have a house and a car and kids going to college and all the things that were very much of the boomer generation and Gen X and even moving into successive generations. And now that millennials are on that leading curve of, you know, they're turning 35, 36 this year, they're not babies anymore either, and they're having kids. Is the fact that we see what we're having to talk about tonight proof that the American dream is not long with us? It's just going to remain something very elusive.
I don't really think so. I mean, but then again, I mean, the American dream has always been the American dream, and you know, some people achieve it, some people don't. I think one of the things we need to recognize is that economic growth in the future is going to come about because of us adopting better institutions, of us doing things better, of us having better firms, better universities, you know, better national public radio, better governments, but that we're going to have better governance structures.
Okay, but what does better look like? I mean, better, we that connotes certain things too, but what do you mean when you say better?
Well, the institutions are the structures by which we organize our resource use. And I don't see us using many more resources in the future. I mean, I think we are entering an age of some resource scarcity. And that what we'll find is that institutions, if we're lucky, will adjust to essentially adapt to a world of increased scarcity. Those institutions too, I mean, those governance institutions will be both local, state, federal, and global governance institutions. That's where much of it's going to come. But not just from that, but also from technological change. I mean, it's not as if all of a sudden we're just going to be using tons more wood products, or we're going to end up using tons more oil. I mean, I think our use of resources will be limited. There's going to be tremendous global competition for the resources that are there. So it might be a different type of American dream. But in some ways, we already see the population adapting to it a bit. We see people on their phones, seemingly happy playing video games on phones at times. Some of that is again people adapting to new technologies and using new technologies in different ways.
And the way they're choosing to live and the way they're choosing to exchange goods and services and being able to have a sharing economy. I mean, those things that we weren't necessarily seeing 5 and 10 years ago.
Yes.
In the way that we're seeing now.
Yeah,
I think there's
on this is futures are your thing.
Yeah, but there's two very different answers to this. The global answer to this looks a lot different than the American answer. And so the American answer, you know, there's a great book by Jacob Hacker and this guy named Pearson called Winner Take All Politics. And one of the things I think the book actually establishes pretty concretely is that the reduction in services and institutions to provide basic necessities to middle income and lower income Americans is not declining because of globalization. So I think also globalization gets kind of a bad rap. The reality is that there has been a massive reduction in taxation in the United States since the Reagan administration, which cuts the amount of money that goes back into things like public universities, like education positions,
social services,
like all kinds of social services, which I do think help that kind of transition between major economic dislocation and new kinds of economy or leisure. So I think the problem is that we think that the American dream is coming to an end because somehow globalization is this unstoppable historical force. And the reality is it's a political failure, I think, more than an economic failure. At an international level, I think that answer is not as bright. I think there are what I would call rising expectations, right? That there will be this possibility for development everywhere that's taken place in places like the United States and England. And I would like to see that happen. But the reality is we're coming up against the natural limits of that. We're not running out of – everybody thought peak oil would happen first. But what we're having is sort of peak carbon, right? The problem isn't that we're running out of oil. It's that if we use any more of the oil and coal that we have at the rate that we're using, we're going to have serious economic and ecological consequences to it. So we had to figure out something like a high quality of life within some kind of limited growth. And I agree technology is part of that story, but part of it is also changing where the priorities of distribution are.
You know, one more thing here. But still, when I step back and try to ask what's the key to U.S. economic growth in the future, I mean, I emphasize the better institutions. Yes, we'll see technological development, but the real key is education. And okay, that's what a university professor always says. It's education, but it's K-12 education and higher education. It's really making sure that the labor force can compete with labor forces in other countries. If we really intend to keep our high standard of living, it's going to be kept when we have a well-educated populace. We've made some strides in that realm over the last few years in education reform, but we still have a long ways to go.
Especially if you have a lot of people on their phones playing video.
There is. There's some. Yes, that would be.
But there's a little bit of a tension in that argument, right? Because it's true that I think, I'm also a university professor. I want education to be a kind of value in and of itself. But whenever economic competition is the major question, there have to be winners and losers. And I think the problem is that there's only so much that education can do if you have a shrinking number of jobs and a higher level of productivity. So we have to figure out how to also transition some populations into a kind of post-work economy. And I don't think we have that even on the imaginary table. There have been two pretty good research studies, one that came out of Pew, that have looked at improvements in education in African American and Hispanic communities. And they actually don't translate well to increases in economic well-being. And part of the problem is that it's not clear where they will transition to, right? So a better educated populace is great if you have an economy for them to transition into. But if you have an economy that only needs roughly 50% of the workforce, then it doesn't matter how well educated you are. There will still be losers in the economy, and losers cause Brexit.
We've already seen that because we've had college graduates who are working at McDonald's
right. And
continue to look around for something else. It depends, obviously, what they got their degrees in and whether or not those were, you know, job-worthy or not. But still, some who were very job-worthy that couldn't find jobs and are still trying to pay off very high debt and get employed. You want to butt?
One last point. One last point. But global competition, I mean, for example, trade can lead to winners on both sides of the equation. You know, trade, if it's done within an appropriate framework and some of the losers within a country are compensated, everybody could gain from trade.
I mean, right.
It's not necessary that, like, the U.S. gains and Mexico loses.
Right.
Or Mexico gains and the U.S. loses, as we see.
But that's where the
institutions as we see in the Trumpian world today, where there's just winners and losers. Right. I mean, there is a potential in global competition for everybody to gain from the process.
All right, we're going to take some more of our callers because they've been stacking up, and we promise we'll get you through. If you want to be able to join the conversation, call us now, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to John calling us from Kaneohe, and thank you for your patience. John, are you there?
Yes.
All right, go ahead. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you. You know, they're all talking about the raising of the minimum wage, and we're almost pricing ourselves out of existence because the poor guy that's making $7.25 an hour here, when they raise the price to $15 an hour, he can't compete with the guy in Mexico who's working for $4 an hour. So there's no way that it doesn't seem to me that to raise the minimum wage does any good, because the poor people that are making $7 an hour, the guy that's going to make the bread or sell the tires or whatever, he's got to raise all of his prices to pay the people that work for him the $15 an hour. So it's just a vicious circle, and it goes around and around and around, and the poor guy that's, you know, making the little bit of a wage is not going to come ahead.
All right, let's see what Sumner LaCroix has to say.
Okay, so when I was a 17-year-old kid growing up, I worked as a print typesetter at the local newspaper. I actually took A's, B's, C's, D's.
And set the type in
there? Set the type, yeah. It was kind of – that was just to show how long ago this was. And in inflation-adjusted terms, I earned $9.60 in 1971. Today, the minimum wage in Hawaii is $8.50. It's actually a much – no matter how we look at it, GDP per capita has increased tremendously since then, and yet our minimum wage has gone down. I'm somebody – I don't believe that economic growth that the key to solving our inequality problems is raising the minimum wage, and yet we have a lower minimum wage than we did back in 1971. I think there's some scope to raise the minimum wage, but we just need to keep in mind that as we raise the minimum wage more and more, that there comes some point where negative effects are generated. When we saw very high levels of the minimum wage, studies documented high levels of discrimination against minorities. There was high teenager unemployment. But it did help out people who were, say, older workers who are still earning the minimum wage, who are relatively unskilled. And today, those people are somewhat suffering in income distribution. So I think there's some room to raise the minimum wage. Today it's actually $8.50 in Hawaii. It's supposed to go up again next year in Hawaii to $10. I think there's room to raise minimum wage. But again, as the higher it gets, the more that some of the negative consequences may start to overwhelm anything that's positive about it.
Yeah, I think the fear of those jobs going overseas is sort of unfounded, given that so much of the growth is in the service economy. So we're not likely to see hotels move from Hawaii to Mexico. I mean, there may be some, given the cost of tourism. But the reality is that, and I agree, that there's only so much you can raise the minimum wage, in part because the minimum wage is a really inefficient way to move wealth around.
I agree.
Yeah, you know, if you want to deal with inequality, you can't do it on a wage scale. There are much more efficient ways to do that.
I'll
give an example that Saskia Sassen uses, which I thought was really helpful, which was that she was talking about the 2008 crisis and how much capital disappeared. And her point was that, you know, given the way that the global economy now works and algorithmic trading and all sorts of other reasons why there can be these kinds of major crashes and currency feedbacks, you know, we probably aren't in a position yet politically to have the will to regulate that. But imagine if the amount of wealth that was being generated by derivatives had been taxed at the effective tax rate, say, in 1950 or 1960. Well, what would have happened? Tons of that money would have been siphoned off from the market. And it would have been put into things like roads, bridges, infrastructure, schools, national security, you name it. And then what happens when the economy crashes? Roads and bridges don't disappear, right? Capital disappears, but roads and bridges don't. So I think, you know, if we're going to focus on why we're not seeing the redistribution of wealth that we want to see, right? Why it's accumulating in a very small portion of the population, there are much better fights to have than the minimum wage.
But that also goes back to a lot of people with very anti-taxation sentiment saying, I don't want that.
But again, I think that's a political issue. I mean, this is where I think Hacker is very persuasive. The Republicans ran a better PR campaign against taxes than Democrats ran on behalf of them. We have to start making better arguments for why it's more efficient for large institutions to gain wealth and build things than it is for each individual to be responsible for their own little piece of education, security, fire departments, etc.
All right, we're going to take some more callers. Going now to Matthew calling us from Kaimuki. Aloha, Matthew. Glad you called us back.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. My comments concern the globalization section of the discussion. I'm glad to hear people mentioning globalization finally, because most of the coverage I read talks about dissatisfaction with wages and age disparities and stuff like that. But I think when you use the term nationalism, it's not quite right, because I don't think nationalism is incompatible with being part of these groups and organizations. I think America is incredibly nationalist, but we're part of plenty of organizations and trade organizations and such. I think the correct word would actually be isolationism, and I think that's the reaction to globalization that is finally happening after 100 years of that.
All right, well, let's see what our panel has to say about that one.
What's that?
So, Matthew, I want to get you an answer back on that one, because, okay. I mean, those have been some of the ways in which this whole conversation has been characterized, that, you know, countries feel that they are losing their identity by being part of a larger group like the EU, and that they have some real impetus to go back to having their sense of, you know, who they were prior to being part of this whole large group of countries that are being administrated and run from Brussels.
This is certainly one way to characterize the debate, is to look at people who basically say globalization is something that we have. It's hard to go back on. We're getting gains from globalization, but what we need to do is to manage it better. We need to have better institutions that manage globalization. We need to have more. We need to be able to redistribute some of the gains from the people who gain a lot to the people who are losing out from globalization. And that this is kind of the establishment view. You know, these are people out there, like economists like myself, who are pushing for open markets, generally open markets. That's the establishment view. The other view is, no, globalization is a mess. It really hasn't worked. What we need is more isolationism. We don't need as much trade. We don't need as much foreign investment. We don't need the internet to go across borders. We basically need more isolation. I see that as really one of the main differences that we have in the United States and in Europe about politics, this isolation view where the globalization stuff is just ultimately flawed, and the other view where, no, we just need to manage it better.
Jess, weigh in on that.
I think we also have a naming problem. I don't think globalization is one package, right? So there are portions of economic globalization, there are processes of political globalization, there are processes of cultural globalization. And I think those all have different kinds of effects. I think that's just as true of nationalism. So there's a big difference in, you know, there have been periods where actually nationalism was kind of great. So, you know, people always talk about, oh, well, isn't Whitman kind of a conservative because he was a nationalist poet? Well, no, because he was espousing nationalism as a way to overcome sectionalism, right, to try to heal the wounds of the Civil War. Well, okay, well, then what about French nationalism? Well, French nationalism was great when it was trying to unify multiple provinces of France in an attempt to democratize the country. It's not so great when it's Marie Le Pen.
Exactly. Yeah.
So there, I think there's a difference between a kind of active process of nationalization and then a reactive process of national identification. And when it starts to turn into that kind of virulent form of patriotism, it very rarely has to do with who you are and very often has to do with who you aren't. And I think that's one of the ways you can tell the difference between different kinds of nationalism. When it's that process of nationalization, it's about building around ideals and aspirations. When you tip the other way, it's generally about why you're not Mexican or you're not Syrian.
All right. We're going to take a few more callers. If you want to join the conversation, call us now, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number to use. Or from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, 877-941-3689. We're talking about, is this really what we're witnessing, the end of globalization? Or is it just changing to something that we've yet to really get our arms around? And what does it mean to have more of a nationalist push in different countries or isolationist? We're looking at all these terms and what it means as they're seemingly happening around the world and changing the world around us. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Ben from Kahana Bay. Aloha, Ben. Welcome to Town Square.
Hey, good. These are very good comments. I think a lot of the issues that we find ourselves in, a lot of it, we are on the bottom, you know. We're not getting, we don't need minimum wage, we need livable wages. Livable wages should be the standard, not minimum wages. Most of the people doing minimum wages are mothers with small children. They have to feed their families. Number two is that a lot of the trade agreements are between corporations and not so much countries. So they're the ones who call the shots on who gets what, where, and when.
Okay, well, we're going to take up that a little bit. You know, that's sort of a very popular perspective, that it's really not countries making the decisions. It's big corporations which are influencing the countries, and yet it is the country. They are the countries making those trade agreements. But his point about the minimum wage and livable wage, is there a real difference in that in your mind?
You know, there's lots of different perspectives on this. This is an old question in both politics and economics, is how do we ensure that people at the lower end of the spectrum who are not earning enough to survive are able to make it? And there's countries recently that have considered a minimum income. Switzerland. It was roundly rejected by the voters, but it got in the ballot. There was a good percentage of the population that supported it. I'm a big supporter of the earned income credit. Hawaii doesn't have it. There's like 26 states that do have it. The federal government has it. It's basically a wage subsidy that's paid by the state. Yes, it's another state program where essentially we lose tax revenue because of it, but it has tremendously positive side effects. Whereas the minimum wage, when we look at it, has tends to have negative side effects. The earned income credit has very positive side effects.
People tend to
use less drugs. We tend to see less crime. There's less pregnancies out of wedlock. We find that people getting the earned income credit are more likely to get education. Again, that's aside from the actual subsidies that are paid out.
And the data that we have for that comes from where?
There's numerous studies. I'd be happy to send a few references to people if they want to email me. But there's numerous references on that. I mean, there's just lots of very good studies on that recently. So the earned income credit, why don't we have it? Well, it's a program where state legislators really need to take a hard look at what else they're doing with the state budget. And this is a place where I think that we desperately need this. I want to note, too, that this – I'm certainly not alone in this. There's all these other groups of the state legislature that believe this is a real complement to anything that we're doing to essentially help lower-income groups in Hawaii.
Jarvis.
Yeah, I mean, the Netherlands has actually expanded their basic income guarantee to four major cities now, and they're actually seeing, similar to the earned income credit, really positive benefits. So, I mean, one of the other things that Sachs actually notes in his paper on automation is that automation and these sort of explosions in productivity create this weird snake eating its tail, right, where it massively increases wealth at the top because you don't have to pay labor. It costs major costs. You can decrease the cost of the thing that you're producing. But because labor was the way that we redistributed wealth, it really cuts down the number of consumers. So one of the other advantages of something like a basic income guarantee or even, you know, other kinds of earned tax credits is that people at the lower end of the spectrum, when they get money back, they tend to spend it, right? When a tax cut happens at the top, there's only so much one person can consume. But the reality is, if we want a consumer-driven economy and we want a service-driven economy, then you need large numbers of people who consume and can consume services. And I don't think there's a way to do that with the minimum wage, meaning that the amount you would have to increase minimum wage to make it a livable wage in some place like Hawaii is, would crush lots of small businesses and make a really high barrier of entry to new economies.
So I always say the minimum wage, there's two types of businesses. So one type of business, say your fast food restaurant, there's endless good studies. For example, by David Card at University of California, Berkeley. Davis basically said, what happens when you raise the minimum wage at fast food restaurants? Well, it turns out that there's not a lot of job loss. People keep going in and buying the fast food, even if they have to pay a few more cents to get their hamburgers late at night or in late afternoon. On the other hand, there's other types of jobs where you really are competing with people overseas. And that if, for example, if we're talking about a T-shirt factory in South Carolina that is all of a sudden forced to pay, instead of $8, $15 an hour, they can't raise their price. They're in an internationally competitive market where the price is set by international markets. They end up losing profits. Some of those firms go out of business. That's a real disaster in that type of circumstance. And so I look at the minimum wage. It's one where it helps out with some firms. It's not that big of a deal. With other firms that are competing in international markets, it is more of a big deal. And so it's something like the earned income credit. It doesn't have that type of effect. I mean, it tends to actually slightly lower wages, and then on the offset, the subsidy is far greater than the reduction in wages. This actually tends to help out the firms that are participating in export markets. So, myself, I just really believe we need to focus. We do need to focus on how can we assist unskilled workers in getting higher incomes. And that's net incomes after taxes. And then we need to look at the best tools that are available. And I just think it's not that the minimum wage, the whole emphasis on the minimum wage leads us to really, it obscures the debate that there might be better tools available and that we ought to be looking at why are these people earning such low incomes to begin with.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is because they don't have enough education.
Okay, right. Hang on a second before you jump in here, Jarvis. I just want to remind everyone that we're talking about what's happening in the world and how is it impacting what we have known as globalization for many, many years. What we've seen is a European Union over the last 40. Those words keep being used, but their meanings are changing. And what does that mean for us as we're looking at it circa 2016, half the year already gone, and coming into the presidential election, and how these words are being used, especially the word jobs? What does that mean as you take a look at the world around you immediately within Hawaii, within the United States, and certainly globally? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I want to ask you about this whole conversation that we had in Hawaii and are still having about the minimum wage. And we've talked a lot of, you know, several of our callers have called in to finger that particularly. But the notion of a livable wage, we don't seem to be able to quantify that as well during a legislative session. That seems to be a lot of cross-pollination with the word, you know, minimum wage, and yet you two are talking about very different things. Are we going to see more, do you think, of really distinct conversation about a livable wage based on what we've now seen with the Brexit, based on a lot of the rhetoric that we were hearing during the presidential election as we begin to prepare for the next legislative session in Hawaii, that this might have a way of tweaking it a bit? Jarvis?
Well, I think there are two big accelerants which could make that suddenly an issue, where it would have the kind of reverberation that you see with Brexit. One is credit card debt, and the second one is student debt. So when people suddenly find themselves unable to manage their debt load such that they can pay for very basic things, then I think wages will not be a significant way to deal with that problem, right? So we have a serious debt problem. And then we have very basic necessities, which we didn't used to pay for. So almost all of us, even if we send our kids to public school, are supplementing our kids' public schools. They don't have enough resources. We're constantly having to donate money in the form
of fundraisers and buy stuff.
All sorts of things. And so there are all of these new costs, which we're folding in to old wages, which have been relatively stagnant since the 1970s, and expecting people to be able to pay more and more, and then adding to that the financialization of debt, right? So there's a real economy now in buying up people's debt and the sort of individual kind of zombie debt that comes back and then garnishes wages and does other things. So I think, if we have another major debt crisis like 2008, but it's based on
– not when?
No, I think it's a win on credit card debt or on student debt. Although I will say, this is one thing that Hillary Clinton has really picked up from the Sanders campaign. And I don't think it's quite as bold as Sanders' version of it. But, Hillary Clinton is now seriously talking about how to deal with not just future student debt, but sort of expanding the Obama program, which has tried to at least peg the repayment rates of student debt to actual incomes. And then also after 20 years for undergraduate debt, forgive debt. And then in graduate debt, after 25 years, forgive the debt. So I think those kinds of options are at least becoming politically possible to talk about. The question is either the local, legislature or Congress going to consider something like that?
Weigh in, Sumner.
Well, we're certainly we're certainly at a crossroads in Hawaii and in the United States as far as funding for, say, higher education. In Hawaii, the state subsidy for higher education has been falling over the last 5 years. That's unfortunate because we're at a point really where people in Hawaii could benefit from receiving more education. The types of industries that are likely to be created here in the future are ones where people are going to need more education. There's no reason to believe that tourism is going to be the engine of growth for the future. We always talk about, maybe people in tourism don't need that much education. Maybe they don't need a higher education. But this is not true because that will not be the engine of growth in the future. There's only so many tourists that could be brought here.
Lyft is Lyft. Yeah.
The declining subsidies at the state level, but at the federal level, when we look at essentially the system that subsidizes kids going to college, what we find is it's a mess. There's a great study by Sue Donarski at Michigan State University that just basically notes that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. I mean, what the study should do is make sure that two groups of people get a higher education. One is people who are particularly meritorious, who are really, really good, that we make sure those people get to the best schools and that we fund them appropriately. And the second group are people who are less able to pay. Okay, and you look at what the current system does, and it doesn't do that at all. I think in some ways, Bernie Sanders, whether we agree with him or not on the free tuition, has done us a favor by forcing us to look at the education issue. And even if we don't want free tuition, I'm not a big fan of free tuition. We desperately need to reform the financing system for higher education in this
All
country.
All right, we got to leave that for a moment and get back to some of our callers because I made a promise. Going to Kaylee calling us from Nanakuli. Thanks very much for hanging in there with us, and we appreciate your patience. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you, Beth Ann, for actually having this topic. Hopefully your guests can figure out what I'm trying to ask here. You made mention of there being a post-work economy where perhaps because of efficiencies, increased productivity, there would have potentially be a 50% decrease in the labor force that's required. But you also touched upon the fact that then you also have a smaller consumer base, because 50% of the people, have to find a post-work way of fulfilling their needs. I guess my question for you is, separate from you're talking about the earned income credit, what are the policy issues that we should be looking at as a country as relates to consistently pushing for higher return on investment, increased profit margins, which are all good, but again, it focuses on a smaller base earning larger revenue. Where's the balance in that? Because I especially see that with automation.
All right, let's take that question and see if we can get you some answers. And Kaylee, thanks so much for the call. Who wants to take that first? Jarvis,
well,
you want to go?
I'll say I think automation is unstoppable. So half of Foxconn has automated in the last 2 years. It's one of the largest makers of chips for Apple. Adidas, which was a huge shoe company being made in Vietnam, has moved back to Germany to a 100% automated factory. Right? These are unstoppable forces in some ways because there are more than economic benefits. Right? When you don't have a labor pool, you don't have to deal with problems like unions. You don't have to deal with problems like demands for higher wages. There are all sorts of reasons why automation, in addition to being more efficient, can be politically more valuable to the people who own the factories. So I think there's only so much you can do to slow the rate of automation, which means you have to have a pretty major way to create a consumer base, even potentially artificially. Otherwise, the stuff that those robots make won't get purchased.
Okay. And very briefly, Sumner, because I want to get back to some of these callers.
You know, I just want to note that I think it's really important to ask yourself what are the most important issues for like the Hawaii economy or the federal economy. For Hawaii, I see two big issues. And one is essentially taking a much closer look at business formation in the state, the barriers that we put up to businesses forming. The second one would be infrastructure at the state level. At the federal level, infrastructure is a big problem too. And I think we need to take a closer look at that. But to my own mind too, the whole aging in the United States, that we're facing the age where people are retiring, people are drawing Medicare. The federal government managing those programs is going to be really important. It's interesting how this election is really not focused on those issues, and maybe rightly so. I mean, immigration and terrorism and the slow economy are on people's minds. But the federal government's management of these big entitlement programs, this is an issue in past presidential campaigns. I kind of think that before we get done, unfortunately, we've got 3 months ahead of us here on this. 4 months. We have a lot of time ahead of us in the presidential campaign. I think we will get back to some of the big entitlement programs because managing those efficiently will be a big deal for U.S. economic growth.
All right. Going to go back to the phone lines and hear from John calling us from Kaimuki. Aloha, John. Welcome to Town Square.
Hey, aloha. I wanted to bring you guys back, I guess, to I hear you talking about the redistribution of wealth and subsidies and whatnot to the lower end of the economy, and I just wanted to hear your feedback in regards to my situation. So I quit working construction in my mid-20s to put myself through undergraduate, started working, and put myself through a master's program. In the past few years, I've learned from my accountant, you know, I'm at a point now where I make good money, and I lose tax write-offs like my student loans. My children's write-off, I provide for 4 children, and my children's write-off is phasing out. It's like I make more money, I pay more money in taxes, and then I even lose these benefits that I had when I'm making less money. And I, you know, it's...
So it sounds like you're asking about
as a renter. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It sounds like you're asking about being disadvantaged because you're actually making more and doing well.
Well, and it's you know, I'm living, you know, I'm blessed, but I mean, I put myself through school. I paid for my way through school. You know, I've worked since I'm 13 years old, right? You know, and I'm still living as a renter. And it's, you know, I feel like I'm where I should be doing well, but frankly, I'm struggling with a wife and 4 children trying to get by still. And
okay,
everybody needs help. I'm not saying that. I'm interested in hearing your feedback on where people such as myself are at in this economy because I don't feel like.
Yeah, you're talking about middle class and what's happening with the fact that you've done all the right things, and although the music went round and round, it didn't necessarily come out where you thought it was going to. Jarvis, how representative is he?
I think fairly representative. You know, I mean, I even look at the numbers in Clinton's education proposal that it's going to provide substantial tuition assistance to people who make under $125,000. And that actually sounds like a reasonable number to kind of my childhood estimates of wealth. And then I think about what my wife and I make, and we wouldn't qualify. And yet we're renters. We have zero savings, right? Like, you know, there is there is an expectation for the kind of professional economy one enters into that will produce certain kinds of wealth. And the economy is not particularly well structured for that. I think particularly in Hawaii, where property income rates don't really accord and many other things like education.
Okay, let's go to another caller because I think you're probably going to agree that he's pretty representative of what you're seeing too.
Sure.
Let's go to Tom calling us from Waimea. Tom, are you there?
Yes, hi. And I was just wondering about this being a global conversation. I don't see how the United States could go into an isolationist type of a footing with the amount of money that we owe from loans to so many different countries such as China or Japan. And after the previous administration for years borrowed from those countries to pay for a war, which no one else has actually kicked in money for, so with trillions and trillions of dollars in debt.
How can we be isolationists? Yeah. Gotcha.
Exactly.
All right. Let me give you an answer from Sumner LaCroix. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think we can be isolationists. I mean, I think the idea of being isolationist is really foolish. I mean, that doesn't mean, for example, though, that we have to have totally free financial flows. There's a lot of economists that tend to believe that we might want to have some restrictions on short-run financial flows. There's lots of countries that do. It's not to say there needs to be perfectly free trade in each and every good. But on the whole, if we decided to become an isolationist country, our overall income would fall. Some people would gain. Some people would lose. We're much better off trying to figure out how at the higher level of incomes we can redistribute the pie better.
All right. We're going to go to another caller, Mark, calling us from Kapahulu. Aloha, Mark. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I just wanted to see what the feedback was on the global structure of the economy. It seems like, you know, for the past, you know, since Thatcher and Reagan, we've been living in this neoliberal type of structure. And not saying that we should go to socialism or to communism, but maybe we should start thinking of a post-capital future.
Okay, let me stop you right there because I want to get you an answer. And unfortunately, time is always our master. So very quickly, you want to give him your take on that, Jars?
Sure. I mean, I think that the critical component of neoliberalism is, you know, political austerity rather than austerity out of economic necessity, right? So I think that undermines a lot of it. The sort of next part of that, and I'll try to keep it brief, is that, you know, the reality is that the isolationists are not really isolationists, right? So, and, you know, there was another huge immigration backlash in the late 80s. And one of the leaders of it was the governor of California. It was a guy named Pete Wilson, was sort of like the poster child of the pre-Trump, right? Really nationalistic, really borderline racist, lots of dog whistle politics. He was the first governor to ask for an exemption from the 1990 Immigration Act, which actually restricted immigration. And the reason why is California's economy got crushed by not having immigration to be able to maintain their agricultural economy. So isolationists will come and go. The question is what kinds of effects we'll feel very quickly and then how we'll react to them.
All right, Summer, you got about 45 seconds.
We have always had roller coaster attitudes toward immigration. If you go back and you look at the turn of the century, around 1900, we had the most people at that point who were born overseas than we had in U.S. history. It was about 15%. Today, we're at about 13%. As that percentage tends to rise, we tend to find usually some backlash against immigrants. It's not that surprising in political terms. But now what we had back then, too, at the turn of the century was also very high levels of trade, very high levels of foreign investment. There was a gold standard. Basically, we were tied to an international standard for money. And there was a big backlash then. It's not surprising to me that there's a big backlash now. A lot of it really is how is it managed? I mean, what we need to do is try to figure out what are the authentic forces and try to figure out ways to manage them within a framework of globalization.
Which means we'll probably have another conversation about that. But thank you both very much for coming in tonight. Sumner LaCroix, Professor of Economics and University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization Research Fellow. Also, thanks to Professor Jairus Grove for coming back. He's the Director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies and an International Relations Professor. Glad to talk to both of you. We'll do it again. And thanks very much for joining us tonight on Town Square. We'll be back with you live next week, and I'll see you tomorrow morning right back here at 8 o'clock for The Conversation. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.